Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Elkon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, we've got this pursuit of happiness business tucked into the Declaration of Independence, but the reality is we're all going to pursue happiness whether or not there's a document telling us we've got an unalienable right to do it. What we need is a document telling us that we need to pursue the less fun feelings and emotions because it turns out they have a lot of benefits for us. Well, that document is here, and it's the science-based book, The Upside of Your Dark Side, Why Being Your Whole Self, Not Just Your Good Self, Drives Success and Fulfillment. And one of the authors, Dr. Todd Kashian, who wrote the book with Dr. Robert Biswas-Diener, is here to talk about just that tonight. Stick with us for what's sure to be an illuminating show. Hello, Todd.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you. I love this book. There's so much on positive psychology and get rid of your negativity. And your book, it really lays out this very persuasive science-based case for our neglect of these all these negative emotions.
Yeah, our job is not to say that positive emotions are bad or we want people to be less loving and compassionate and kind. It was more of, we felt as if when we go to the self-help book section or we listen to motivational speakers or we hear workshops, it's as if these people are not living in the same reality that we are, which is some people we like more than others. Some coworkers are obnoxious and annoying. Some people like to exploit other people, are obsessed with power, are obsessed with how they can take advantage of us and use us. And some people are just interesting people, but we don't want them to be in our full inner social circle. And so how do we navigate a world where we don't know what's going to happen when we wake up for the next morning, in a world where we have this full range of emotions, and how do we be successful and have healthy relationships and have ambitions such that when we attain them, we feel happiness and a sense of meaning in life? And that's what this book is about.
Yeah, these are very good questions. Now, you're coming off a little muffled, so can you maybe, if you're using your phone on speaker, talk directly into it? Because I really thought your book was important and pretty breakthrough, and I want to make sure we hear you. And I want to have you tell, there's a very interesting tale at the beginning of your book about the training for elite special forces soldiers. So tell us that story.
Sure. We spoke to a number of people from the armed forces, and they don't like to put a lot of this on record, but one of the ways where they determine whether a recruit is at sufficient fitness to make it into the armed forces is this ambiguous task where you're basically left alone in a strange place and you're told just to keep moving. And these recruits are carrying a rucksack, which is about 20 to 30 pounds, upwards of 60 pounds, and they don't know what to do. They don't know whether to run as fast as possible to be the first one at the finish line. They don't know whether to pace themselves, if this is going to be a multiple-mile marathon. Some people run in groups. Some people run by themselves and try to be sort of a little bit selfish and focused. And the test is not a check of whether you have good stamina. The check is The test is not a check of your cardiovascular ability. It's not a test of whether you're good at getting allies and forming a good tribe so that you can leverage your strengths with other people. It's about mental strain. It's about, can you handle a situation where you have no idea what you need, what the task requires, and be agile enough to find whatever tool is necessary to get through this task of running down a strange street and not knowing when it ends. And what they find is it's not the physical strain, it's the mental strain that they're interested in. Will you be fully available and fully functional in an adverse situation where you don't know who your enemies are, aren't sure who your allies are, and aren't sure when the task is going to end? And this is pretty much what is required of people in the Marines, the Air Force, the Armies, and the Navy when they're involved in combat or in missions in Somalia and Vietnam and, you know, Singapore and countries where you've got kids from Idaho that have never left the middle of the country before.
And you talk about the ability to tolerate psychological discomfort, which psychologists call distress tolerance.
That's right. It's one of the best predictors of whether you're going to be successful in science, in athletics, in terms of being a great writer, a great thinker, can you handle the natural strains that come from pushing yourself on a task that requires extreme mental and physical exertion and requires you to spend time with people where you don't necessarily know what the motives are of the people that you're interacting with. And so this is a very powerful concept in terms of understanding who's going to be successful, who's going to fail, and who's going to be great at something. And it's not something you can measure with an IQ test, an SAT exam, or an MCAT. It's something that's a little bit more complicated, and that's why I think it's been ignored, is because there's no icon, there's no emoticon, like a yellow happy face for happiness when it comes to distress tolerance, and yet this is what we want for our children. And this is what we want in terms of coworkers that when we work on projects for long term.
And you make the point that all psychological states have some adaptive advantage, including those we turn away from. And just to explain, adaptations are about how we do in a particular environment. I'm not explaining for you, of course, but for people who maybe aren't as familiar with that use of adaptation. So tell us about that. Because we think we really strive for happiness. But these other states, they really do have adaptive advantages within certain environments, especially.
Yeah, I mean, I think we forget how important it is to understand, if you want to make a difference in the world, which almost every one of us does, if you want to help the next generation be highly impactful in improving the world, with whatever medium they want, whether it's art, whether it's science, whether it's sports, whether it's making friends, romantic partners, you know, whatever means that they're going to do that, we have to look at how human beings actually are, and not what we want them to be or hope they would be like. And this is where evolutionary psychology comes in, which is we're talking about millions of years. We're talking about 2,000 to 20,000 generations that led us certain ways to respond the particularly difficult functional problems in our environment. And most of those problems did not require us to be happy for us to be successful. Most of them required an emotional state that motivated us to escape a threat, find friends, find romantic partners, sustain our romantic partners, fend off rivalries, or invest in the next generation so our genes could last past our own lifetime. And so we have this broad range of emotions that are actually exactly what we need for a number of situations that's better than being happy. And just to give you a concrete example of this, you know, if you were to ask yourself, which emotional state is best to produce a persuasive message to convince someone that my opinion on an issue such as abortion or Ferguson or immigration, to persuade someone else that my views are essentially have some validity to them. You're more effective, you're more persuasive when you're slightly somber or slightly unhappy or sad as opposed to being in a happy state. And that's not necessarily intuitive. And the reason that scientists have discovered this, it's because when we're somber or slightly unhappy, we create more vivid, concrete examples. We're more likely to be more analytical and thinking about what does the other person care about and how do I match what they're interested in. And when we're in a happy state of mind, we don't think that thoroughly about another person's perspective because we get complacent. We're in an emotional state that tells us, that's a signal to us when we're happy, that things are going well, might as well keep how things are going. But when the goal is to persuade someone, the goal is actually to change the situation and change another person's behavior. And so it's not that sadness or being somber is definitively better than happy, but if the goal is to persuade and influence someone, which is what teachers, parents, and workers are doing all the time, or anybody who's been in a romantic relationship for more than 15 seconds, trying to persuade and influence people is what we do all the time. We just don't like to talk about it. When you're happy, you're less effective.
And you talk about emotions as a tracking system for experience. And you say to provide a thumbs up or thumbs down to help you approach or avoid a given situation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, one of the big problems in America in particular, and this kind of culture of cheerfulness and this culture of trying to be happy, as you mentioned in the beginning, from the Declaration of Independence, this is our inalienable right, is we forget that these other emotional states are here for a reason. And if your goals are, I want to stimulate someone to devote more effort towards something, I want to get someone to be more willing to conform to the social rules that we have. So it might be keeping the house clean, taking your shoes off, not using profanity around my kids. In these types of situations, happiness gets in the way. And intuitively, we've been taught in our culture that being happy is the ideal state to be in. It's when we're most productive, we're most flexible, we're most creative. And the fact is, there are very clear instances when happiness is actually a problematic emotional state to be in.
Well, can you talk a little bit about what people who desperately try to, and these are your words, escape, conceal, and avoid negative states miss out on? And I guess I should ask you to backtrack a little bit. Tell us about some of these negative emotions you talk about.
Sure. So, I mean, if I was just to list a few emotions, the basic negative ones, and when I negative, I mean that they're uncomfortable to have. Anger, sadness, anxiety, boredom, guilt, embarrassment. And you were to ask yourself, which one are you the least comfortable experiencing? And which one are you the least comfortable when someone's expressing it to you? And which one do you have the least understanding about when you're feeling it or someone else is feeling it? You realize that we all have biases about these uncomfortable emotions, and that gets in the way from us appreciating what they are. And the fact is, you know, if the situation is about you're in negotiations with somebody and you're trying to get someone to give in a tiny bit, it might just be on a Friday night in terms of trying to figure out what restaurant to go to. Expressing frustration and annoyance is a little bit more effective than showing happiness and joy. And if the situation is about soliciting help and support from other people, you're more likely to get it if you're slumping a little bit and expressing sadness as opposed to happiness. And we know that in terms of a sense of self-doubt is often exactly what teachers, public speakers, and educators and students, it's useful for them to experience self-doubt because it motivates them to double down on their attention and whatever's being taught to them. And so the important lesson from this is when we try to take away people's negative thoughts and feelings to feel happier, when we push them to push these thoughts aside and try to put a smile on their face and fake it till you make it, this actually makes people less effective quite often. But this is the culture that we have that pretty much dominates the United States at this time.
Yeah, you have a fascinating chapter on the rise of the comfort class. Let's get into that a little bit. I guess start with telling us about the American need for air conditioning and what that means.
Well, there's some interesting trends. I mean, if you go back to the 1950s and 60s, you had about 15% of Americans would shower daily, which is, I mean, this is clearly a scary time for dating, but it's only in the 80s and 90s that you have people that were over 75% of people were showering daily. And then when you ask people about what are the absolute necessities I cannot live without, what you find is over the course of the past 25 years, the number of things on that list have increased, of having a toilet that flushes, having air conditioning, having a hot seat in your car for driving in the wintertime, having a central air in your house. And only 15 years ago, these things were, you know, only for the elite, the people with the most financial resources, the top 1% would have these things. What's problematic? Well, it's not problematic to love comfort. I mean, I'm one of those people who goes to a hotel and explicitly says, I like a hard foam pillow, not a fluffy pillow when I go into a hotel. And there's nothing problematic about having a hot seat in your car when you drive in the wintertime. But the more, what scientists have found is the more that we depend and require physical comforts around us at all times, the less tolerant we are of being uncomfortable. And why this is problematic is because everybody's going to be uncomfortable for a good portion of their lives. We're going to be in long lines at the DMV. We're going to be overcharged or at Target every once in a while. We're going to be with people that are going to cut us off on the road on a highway. And we're going to be around people that disagree with our opinions, don't like what we're saying, don't like where we're from, don't like how we dress, don't like our attitude. And just because we might remind them of someone who bullied them when they were in third grade. We can't control other people's behavior. And the more that we require and depend on physical comforts, the less tolerant we are of these distressing states that are pretty normal for everyday life. And so we become psychologically weaker as a function of the greater comforts that we've had over the course of time.
This is actually something that's affected free speech on campus. I support, and the show supports, thefire.org, which defends free speech cases, free speech violations on campus. And both Greg, who has that organization, and I feel that the physical comfort, people are, they're so physically comfortable, they can't deal with any sort of emotional discomfort. And so it leads to, you know, professors being forced to put trigger warnings in the Great Gatsby. You know, I mean, it's so crazy. And so what's the answer for us? I mean, do we all need to take cold showers in camp? Is there an answer? How do we get less prissy about our comfort level?
I think I'm so glad you gave the example of the trigger warnings, because I had a very similar response. I mean, I teach classes on the science of morality, and I talk about whatever is the hot button issue of time. We talk about racism and sexism, and we talked about the UVA incident, whether it was true or false. We know that fraternity and sorority culture and rapes that are happening on college campuses. I mean, it evokes emotions, and I do it purposely because most students, most children, most adolescents, most young adults are what they call emotionally safeguarded away from experiencing discomfort. You have parents there that have worked for so many years to take away their pain from their kids. This was the 70s self-esteem movement that went awry, where everybody got prizes just for showing up, and now you have a generation of 20-somethings that basically feel a sense of entitlement and a sense that they deserve more money that they're getting, and they deserve to take off time whenever they want to, and they deserve to move up the ranks regardless of the years that they have, the expertise that they have, and the performance they've shown. And what happens with this is you have a society of people that are unwilling and unable to understand people that aren't like them and don't think like them. And you have people that are more likely prone to stereotype other people. And you have more of a schism, which is that if I hold these particular views, if you don't hold them, I'm not willing. And this makes you less and less willing to be exposed to uncomfortable emotional experiences. And basically, it's just like if you're treating combat veterans coming home from war who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. The most effective treatment that we had, because I am a clinical psychologist, I have treated many people suffering from anxiety disorders and worked in a couple of VA hospitals. The best treatment that we have is called exposure therapy, which is very gradually and systematically exposing them to the exact things they're afraid of, small little doses. And so in the beginning, you might have people just be shown pictures of what it's like to be in war, a combat veteran coming home. And then after, you might have them see tell them a story of somebody else. And eventually they tell their story, and then they tell the story in more detail, and then they walk to places where they might be exposed to reminders of things of being in war and being in a combat zone. And slowly and surely what happens, you become psychologically cognizant of the fact that you can tolerate discomfort and still move in the direction of goals that you care about. And so the answer to get people to be more tolerant of distress is allowing them to fail a little bit and allowing them to actually go forth and do something, even if you doubt yourself, even if you feel lonely approaching other people, and even if you feel like an imposter giving a talk in front of a room full of people, and realizing that the anxiety is never usually as bad as you actually think it is.
Yeah, that's an important point you bring up about people's inability to actually predict how they're going to feel. We will get to that when we come back. But first, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Todd Kashtan. His book, co-authored with Dr. Robert Biswas-Diener, is The Upside of Your Dark Side, Why Being Your Whole Self, Not Just Your Good Self, Drives Success and Fulfillment. So talk about this, our success. We're kind of bad at predicting it, not only what makes us happy, but what a situation is going to be like when we get into it.
Some people call this emotional time travel, and we do this all the time. When we make decisions about, should I go to Ecuador for my winter vacation or should I go to the Bahamas, we think about how will I emotionally feel on the beach in the Bahamas where I'm going to have a butler who's going to be bringing me a strawberry daiquiri and everything's going to be paid for in advance and I don't have to ever whip out my credit card or my money, whereas in Ecuador, it's going to be a little bit more challenging. You're going to have great surfing if you are a surfer. You're going to have beautiful villas that you can rent, but no one's going to be bringing you drinks. You're going to have to walk into town with a bunch of people that don't speak English and purchase your groceries just like you do at home. It's a more challenging experience. It's interesting. So we can make a decision based on, do I want the intrigue and the anxiety and the excitement of Ecuador, or do I want the tranquility and the joy that comes from the Bahamas? Kind of, we make our decisions based on emotional time travel, what we think we'll feel. The problem is, as you described, we suck at this. Human beings are horrendous at predicting what they're going to feel in the future. And this is exactly what we use to make decisions about, should we enter a romantic relationship? Should I approach that attractive guy or girl at the other end of the bar? Which university should I attend to? It's the emotional feelings that we get. And there's a couple of ways that we make problems with this. One is the impact bias. We mispredict the sheer power, strength of emotions we're going to have. And if you think of grade school teachers, and they spend so much of their lives hoping to get tenure, thinking, once I get tenure and have job security, I'll feel the sense of peace. I'll be able to teach the way I want to. I won't have to worry about what my teachers say behind my back or to other teachers. And what we find when we study people over long periods of time is when teachers get tenure, their anxiety doesn't get lower. Their calmness doesn't get higher. Their stress actually goes up because now they feel they have to prove that they were worthy of tenure in the first place. And in a similar vein, when you have people that are that require an organ transplant and you ask them, do you want to meet the person who's such a benevolent, kind person that they're going to donate an organ and put it into your body so you survive? Do you want to meet them? 80 to 90% of people say, absolutely. I want to have this Hallmark moment Well, we cry and we hug each other, and I'm going to have a new best friend because a part of me is now attached to them because their part of them is inside me. They're going to come to every Thanksgiving dinner I have. I'm going to text them every day. And what you find in reality is that when people meet the person that donated an organ, they do have an amazing transcendental meeting. And then in about 2 weeks later, it kind of fizzles out, and usually it's just one other person that they feel obligated to call, and they don't enter their inner sanctum of friends. Whereas those people that never meet the person that donated an organ to them, their kindness and joy and happiness never comes down again. And the reason is because they can't make sense of it. They can't understand, what kind of crazy world do I live in that someone actually would give me a kidney and wouldn't want credit for it? I've got to be a nicer person. I need to be. I'm alive because of them. And it changes you. But here's the big thing about this research. People expect that certainty, that knowing and who the person is and seeing them, that's going to bring me the greatest joy and meaning in life. Diametrical opposite. It's the uncertainty that prolongs pleasure and it brings more intense pleasure. This is problematic because we make our decisions based on emotional guesses that are often wrong.
Yeah, this is so hard. We love this idea that things are certain. And really, if we could embrace the uncertainty, from what I've read in your book, it sounds like we would be much, well, happier, but also use this great term wholeness, that this is about becoming whole, that we use all these sides to guide us.
Yeah, when people valiantly pursue happiness, it's problematic because you can't, there's no switch, there's no dial in your brain where you can decide to become happier. I mean, if there was, there wouldn't be a $2 billion self-help market in the first place. I wouldn't have to write these books, and I wouldn't give workshops, and all of my colleagues, they wouldn't exist. They'd be working on quantum physics right now. The reason that this industry exists is because you can't just make yourself happier. I mean, if you or I was anxious because, you know, we had a fight with our romantic partner before getting onto this conversation, we couldn't just say to ourselves, okay, I'm just going to turn the dial. I'm going to be calm and more comfortable when I get onto the air. We don't have that ability. And yet, somehow, this is the advice everyone passes everybody. I remember when I gave a TEDx talk in front of 7,500 people in Utrecht in the Netherlands, and then the person backstage was, just remember, you have to be calm, and that's the best way to get the audience. It's the best advice I can give you. And I remember thinking to myself, you think I wouldn't know that? You think I'd require someone to tell me that actually I should be calm before I get, if I had that ability, I use it every second of my life, but I don't have that ability, and we can't just become happier. And what we know from the science is there are other ways. The way to getting to happiness is indirectly, is by living a life where you're in the present. You're constantly exploring your environment, exploring who you are, exploring the people that surround you, that your surroundings, and pursuing things that matter to you. And sometimes you catch happiness along the way, and sometimes you don't. And this notion of being whole is about, we have 16, 20 sides to our personality. It's like those big, huge Dungeons & Dragons dies, those role-playing game dies. And we often appreciate and have a love affair with a few sides of our personality, the kindness side, joyful side, of the tranquil side, of the agreeable side of our personality. And there are other sides of our personality that are either uncomfortable or they're not socially appropriate to talk about. So being selfish, being manipulative, trying to gain power in a situation, being argumentative. And sometimes these sides of our personality is exactly what's required for the circumstance that we're in. And being whole is being able to honor all the sides of our personality and appreciate that they're tools that with the right dose and the right amount of skill and the proper circumstance is exactly what we need. And if you're not willing to be whole, you will never reach your full potential and understand what you're capable of, and you'll never maximize your potential for performance and creativity.
Yeah, I think that's so important. I grew up, I didn't have friends till I was 15. I said actually 13 in this current book I have out, but I realized that was aspirational. I just felt kind of ashamed that it took so long. And then you get to be kind of a suck up because once you have friends, you are determined and desperate to keep them. But I had to get to a point where I could be angry. And you make this great point about anger, which I agree with, that it's neither good nor bad. It's what you do with it that matters. And you also make the point, it arises because we've been treated unfairly. So, I mean, that's a rational response to, also because it's more productive, to deal with unfairness.
I mean, just think about what's happening right now in terms of New York City, Cleveland, Missouri. I mean, you're talking about, you know, this movement of saying, lives matter, I can't breathe. You're seeing righteous indignation that's happened over the past few weeks. And all these situations are gray, right? There's, you can understand the indignation, which is just one variant of anger on both sides, in terms of if you believe police officers were in the right, or if you believe that these people who are victims were absolutely mistreated, both at the time of their death, also by the judicial system. With all this righteous indignation, you know, regardless of the side that you have, it's a beautiful thing that people are expressing the fact that they believe there are obstacles in the social system in the United States right now, and they're expressing it because they feel that they should have more of a say, more of a voice, and more flexibility in terms of the way they should be treated and the respect that they deserve. And both sides of this are basically expressing that. And this is a healthy thing. There's nothing wrong with expressing anger. Now, it's wrong when you step on other people's toes, loot buildings, physically harm other people, troll other people on the internet, and bully other people. But expressing your anger effectively is, anyone that's been in a marriage, anyone that's raising children knows that you need to be very clear about what your boundaries are in terms of, you should express your anger. And when a woman makes 12 to 18% less than the male who's right next to, in the cubicle right next to them in the workplace, yes, you should express your anger in an effective way such that you make it clear that your manager should express to you, to give you data of why they think that you're 18% less of the worker right next to you, even though you're performing the same way.
Okay, I don't want to go too much there, but I might dispute on that because, for example, I don't have any kids and I work 7 days a week. And when I was at a company, you know, there were people with kids, women who took off with their kids. You know, and that, you know, if you're the worker who's working all the time, maybe that person, maybe there's a reason. I mean, there's an assumption it's discrimination. I don't really want to go there. I just wanted to put in a counterpoint there because your book's too fascinating to, you know, detour off into that stuff. But I like that you said that anger is associated with a more optimistic outlook. You gave all these examples about ways that anger can be positive, but you do say that there's a right way to get angry. So maybe you can tell us that. You talk about the discomfort caveat.
Sure. I mean, one of the things about doing this research for 2 years for this book, Rob and I, the thing that I discovered the most is how uncomfortable people are with anger. I mean, this has come up over and over again. I mean, I just gave a talk at Quantico for the Marines, all the 2, 3, 4, and 5-star generals and their spouses. And this came up even with them. And these are the people who are probably the most emotionally agile people on the planet, potentially. And still, they talked about being uncomfortable with their anger, trying to keep it under control, this worry that if they don't put a cap on their anger, that they're going to turn into Lou Ferrigno from the 70s, the Hulk, and throw things and punch people and hurt people. And people are so worried about being angry, expressing this to their children, that they keep it up, but bottled inside until their kids go to sleep, and then they start fighting with their romantic partners. How do you express anger effectively to get the best possible outcome in a situation? One of the best ways, as you mentioned, is what we call the discomfort caveat, which is being very honest with it, telling people that you're really uncomfortable talking about something that's been bothering you in the relationship. That's something that's been bothering you in the environment. That's something that's bothering you about what they're doing to you. And you're reluctant to even bring it up because you're worried about harming the relationship. And when you say this, that you're worried about bringing up a difficult conversation, people's defenses come down. People are more willing to listen to you. people become more soft-spoken. People become more receptive and open to hearing something that they might disagree with. And when you don't, so you can't rush into a conversation and give them your opinion about something, saying that you don't like the way people talk to you. You need a starting point. So you need to tell people that you're unsure about this conversation. But there's more than that. We know that when people express their anger and they direct it about the person and not their behavior, that's not going to be effective in expressing their anger. So I can
Let me just ask you, because you got into something interesting. What is so disarming, this discomfort caveat? Oh, I'm really angry, and I don't know if, you know, I can talk about this because I'm so upset. What about that is so disarming to people?
Well, we have an initial response to wanting to be right. I mean, this is, humans are just designed this way. We're designed, we want to be right in discussions. We want to win debates. We want to get our badges and our trophies and our gold stars. And we've been culturally trained this way since grade school. And so if we can prevent it from being a competitive situation and instead make it a situation where this relationship will be harmed if I don't get to explain what's bothering me about how you're treating me, that becomes a different type of conversation. It becomes collaborative. And so the disarming part is moving it from a competitive conversation for who wins to a collaborative conversation to get the best possible outcome.
Okay, let me ask you one thing. So is it enough to say, I'm really angry and I don't know if I can keep my cool, or do you need to say, no, I'm worried about that I'll harm our relationship?
Well, I'd be a charlatan if I was to say there's an exact way to do this, and it depends the relationship you have. But let's just say it's your coworker you don't know that well. I think one of the keys is you might not even have to talk about the anger of there's something I've been wanting to talk to you about that's been bothering me, worried. I've been worried about talking about this because there's been no opening to talk about our relationship. Right? So I don't have to mention the anger. I don't have to mention what's wrong. What I have to mention is there's something that's bothering me. I need to get it off my chest. But there hasn't been any opportunity for us to actually talk face to face. And that's all I need. And I'm purposely keeping it ambiguous because I want someone to be interested. I want someone to be attentive. But I don't want someone's defenses up.
Okay, I think I understand. It's sort of like a diving board. And maybe it keys into, you know, there's this the Adam Smith, classic economist, I couldn't remember which century exactly, but he talked about sympathy as a motivator, and that if you get somebody, they're keyed into your feelings like that. It just seems, it does seem to be a really helpful preface to any kind of conversation that's a heated conversation or an emotional conversation.
We want some perspective taking. We want someone to be able to step into our shoes and understand why we would feel the way we do. For someone to get there in this moment, we need someone to actually solicit some level of help towards us, solicit some level of cooperation. And so we're trying to get some buy-in before the real conversation takes place.
Now, you have such a great section on putting anger to work in relationships, but first I want to tell people the name of your book. I am talking with Dr. Todd Kashtan. His book, co-authored with Dr. Robert Biswas Diener, is The Upside of Your Dark Side, Why Being Your Whole Self, Not Just Your Good Self, Drives Success and Fulfillment. You'll find a link to that in the show text for today. So this is such a great section in your book, Putting Anger to Work in Relationships. You discourage statements like, I need to get rid of my anger, or I need to keep my anger in check, and you encourage people to recognize the difference between events they can change and those that are beyond their ability to control.
Yeah, it's fundamental to be situationally aware. Is what are the potential? I mean, when we think about social intelligence or emotional intelligence, the basics of it are: can I understand the motives of other people in the situation? Can I understand what are people looking for? What would bring them, what would be rewarding to another person that I'm talking to? What would get them excited and hot and bothered about something I would talk about? I mean, this is the essence of persuading and influencing other people. People aren't comfortable talking about this because it sounds like some shady used car salesman or politician. We do this all the time. I mean, I think about my roommates before my wife. I think about living with my wife. And I think about how often we make sure the other person sees the amount of housework we put in. Make sure that they happen to be, you know, in the vicinity when I'm doing the dishes or in the vicinity when I change a diaper or make sure that, you know, that I'm going to mow the lawn when I know she's going to be home. I mean, these are all sorts of subtle ways that we're manipulating the situation. And it's not a bad thing. We're just making it clear that we do our share and we're often underappreciated. When it comes to expressing our anger in relationships, we have to be clear that the issue is about how we are responding to the other person's behavior. And I can't say that more slowly enough because it's so fundamental. As soon as I make the anger about, I don't like what you're doing, the defenses go up. As soon as I make it about that you're in the wrong for how you treat me, the defenses might go up. When you're talking in a relationship, you have to be very clear. It's focus on the thing that's bothering you, not person. And make it very, very clear that it's your reactions to it, regardless of their intention, the way it was received, pissed you off. And so, I mean, people make subtle jokes and sarcastic jokes all the time that often fall flat. It was intended to be funny, but it was upsetting in a room full of people. When someone makes a cutting remark about the way that you're dressed, it could go the wrong way. And you have to be very clear about focusing on the thing that bothered you and not the person who is the creator of whatever bothered you.
This sort of dovetails with what you write about guilt and shame. And you write about that these can be motivators for people to improve their behavior. But you also talk about, basically, I think it's been said guilt is about behavior. Shame is about who you are. And it's better that you say better to motivate through guilt, not shame.
Yeah, it's, I mean, we often think of guilt as a really bad thing. I mean, I'm a Jewish and I've had guilt is built into Jewish family structures. I mean, every time you call an aunt or an uncle, the first 15 minutes of the phone conversation is guilt about why haven't you called, been calling me more regularly? Why don't you write? Why don't you spend as much time as your brother does in terms of talking with us? And all of these emotions that they're trying to elicit in you, there's a motive behind this, which is essentially you're not treating us with respect and kindness, and it motivates me to wanting to repair the relationship. But as soon as they make it about that my brother is the nice person and I'm the evil, manipulative, dexter-like psychopath in the family, as soon as that happens, I don't want to repair the relationship. I want to hide from them. I want to delete them back from my phone, and I want to talk to other people. And when it comes to, you know, jails or trying to deal with kids that are a little bit delinquent in the school system, inducing guilt is an incredibly healthy emotion. It's something, as we become more politically correct, we've had the idea that inducing guilt is a bad thing. But we know from research in jails that those inmates that experience the most guilt during their time in jail are the least likely to have recidivism. They're less likely to engage in criminal behavior again. And that those, when you go to jail and you don't experience guilt, you're more likely to go through the revolving door and back and end up back in jail again. You want them to feel good. You want them to know that their behavior was problematic and how it hurt other people, and make it very clear and concrete. And when you raise kids or you're a teacher, the same thing. If you feel as if someone is in the wrong in terms of their behavior, it's okay to call people's behavior. If you do it in public, you're more likely to shame them. And they're not going to help their behavior. They're going to hate themselves. And you're going to see that they're just not going to show up anymore. And you're going to wonder what
happened. You know what? I was just going to mention, you brought up just such an important thing now about this public thing. Steven Pinker talks about this. I write about it in my book, quoting him about this. It's like if you just CC someone on an email where you're saying something to somebody about their behavior, something negative, you know, all of a sudden it just turbos it up to shameful. You know, because that audience, people need to understand that having that audience is so damaging to people.
Yeah, we're social creatures by nature. I mean, you know, you talked about, and I'm so intrigued to read your book, that you're saying you had no friends until the age of 13. I mean,
Thank you. It's called Good Manners, because I don't need tenure. It's called Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say Fuck.
And I will buy it for many people in my psychology department at the university.
Thank you. So anyway, go ahead.
As adults, we are all constantly, perpetually living in a junior high school lunchroom, wondering, we're carrying our lunch tray, wondering, which table should I sit at? Can I sit with the cooler kids? Can I sit with the kids that are physically beautiful, that are strong, that are interesting, that are, you know, alluring, the drama, the artistic, the dramatic, artistic kids? And we're all constantly, perpetually unsure of our sense of belonging in this world. And we all experience loneliness. We all experience rejection and ostracism. And we have these signals, these emotional signals, a sense of embarrassment, social anxiety, fear of being judged. All of these things are useful. These are signals that maybe our behavior is going in the direction such that we're going to be outcast in the tribe that we care about. Problematic, when it becomes problematic, is when we start getting anxious about being anxious. Because once we start getting anxious about being anxious, well, now we start to kind of leave the social world entirely. We worry so much about what we're going to say and how we're going to feel physically, that the tension in our legs and the shakiness in our fingers, that eventually we realize that the only way to get out is actually just to be by myself playing video games alone, 3 leagues under the sea, and we just avoid social contact. But anxiety is not problematic. Guilt's not problematic. Embarrassment's not problematic. All of those emotions allow us to improve our behavior such that we're more likely to do things to win attention from other people, understand other people, take their perspectives, and have a conversation that's a give and take, that's a dance, as opposed to a bunch of monologues. If we didn't have those negative emotions, we wouldn't be able to modulate or modify our behavior to match what other people are interested in.
Right, and that is so positive. And this is what I really love about your book, because not only do you say it's positive, you show all these ways. That chapter where you talk about anger, the right way to get angry, using anger positively, guilt and shame, anxiety. You even have a chapter, which I don't think we can get to today, about these sort of horrible behaviors like narcissism, how you can use those. But first, I want to tell people who I'm talking with. It's Dr. Todd Kashian, his book, co-authored with Dr. Robert Biswas-Diener, and I should get a PhD for saying that, is The Upside of Your Dark Side, Why Being Your Whole Self, Not Just Your Good Self, Drives Success and Fulfillment. And I can say, Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, even though I don't have a PhD, and I'm very proud of that. And it took anxiety and feeling like a failure for a while before I could do that. So I want to ask you an interesting question Greg asked, who he's Skyping me. He says, does Todd think that passive aggressiveness is counterproductive?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. I mean, there's nothing healthy about passive aggressive behavior because you're not solving problems. I mean, you think about, again, there's an evolutionary basis of anger. We experience this emotion when we think that there's a roadblock to goals that matter to us. And passive-aggressive behavior is we kind of sneak underneath that obstacle or sneak around it without the other person seeing it and just want to flick them in the ear or steal their Post-its or, take their pens. And we don't solve the problem. We just get a person agitated, and it makes us – we feel good when we're alone on our couch just smirking, knowing that we kind of got them. But we don't solve the problems. We don't improve our environment, and we don't make our workplace less toxic. We actually are just adding to it. So I strongly push for the expression of low-grade anger, frustration, annoyance, being pissed, and being assertive. And if it harms the relationship, that's okay, because if you express what someone does that's wrong to you and they can't handle it and have that conversation, well, then it's a litmus test that you might be with someone that's so uncomfortable in their skin that maybe this isn't the best person to have in your life in the first place.
Yeah, and actually you reminded me about something. I wanted to mention this before. You were talking about discomfort of approaching people, and as somebody, I talked about my background, not having friends. This woman, we were at LA Times Festival of Books. She's a fellow author, And she said she wanted to go talk to someone. And she said, oh, but I'm not fearless like you are. And I said, I'm not fearless. I'm often or usually afraid when I want to go talk to some, you know, like, quote unquote, important stranger. I just don't let that stop me. And that's something about that discomfort tolerance, even though, you know, like there are ways I'm sure I'm a complete wimp and there are. But, you know, in those ways, in the emotional ways, I try not to be. I try to just do it, as they say.
Oh, and this is what I teach. I have 27-year-old girls, and they just went to a soccer all-star tournament last week. And one of my girls at halftime was telling me that a girl on the other team kept on whispering in her ear, I'm so much prettier than you, over and over again, was just whispering how I'm prettier than you. And she was kind of aghast at this, and she was upset, and it was screwing up her play. And so I was telling her, you know, what do you think she's trying to do? I mean, she wants to steal your energy. She wants to steal your ability to focus on the game. But what can we do to take? I was teaching her about power right there at halftime. Like, what? I mean, you don't want to harm her. But what can you do? How does she get power? She's being funny. Her teammates are laughing, and she's got this kind of the attention. Well, let's come up with a way to kind of do all of that, but not be mean towards her. And so what she came up with, not me, after talking about this, and I wasn't trying to take away her anger. I wasn't trying to take away her sadness or anxiety. Just as you said, I wanted to teach her without saying explicitly, you can go back on that soccer field with all that anxiety and anger and still dribble the ball and still shoot. And what she came up with was every time she said that, she would stop and purposely take her time saying, are you prettier than me? Nah, not even close. And then just go run up the field. And the idea was that she sort of asked this lucid question, and my daughter very casually kind of answered the question and stole the power back because she got the crowd on her side without being mean or aggressive or passive aggressive in the situation. And I think there's a great lesson of, we can do what we care most about despite the presence of pain. And you gave a great example of approaching someone that you find attractive because they're intelligent, they're interesting, they're beautiful. Even though you're anxious, you can go talk to them. And showing that vulnerability is one of the best ways that we form intimacy with other people, is letting people know. When you tell people that you are uncomfortable talking in front of 7,500 people, you'll win much more friends than saying that I felt exuberant, alive, and I felt like nothing could bother me. Well, somebody will clap for you, but people are gonna doubt you and not want to be friends with you afterwards.
I learned this the first time I wrote a book proposal, and our agent then, you know, like, hated us. It was when we were giving free advice in the street corner, and I was like, oh, we're fabulous. He's like, no, tell the real story. Like, my friend was stealing toilet paper because we couldn't afford it. I mean, you know, and that's the stuff. It is the stuff where people just, they like you. You know, even though I don't approve of toilet paper stealing, just for the record. But it's just, you're human then. You're not some, you know, hi, I'm a fabulous god, which is just gross.
No, when we were writing this book and we put on my Twitter account and we told them of how the first time we went down, we had four publishers that interviewed us, four of the big publishers, and we got rejected by all of them. And we were distraught, and we had 6 months to gather ourselves together and revising it and then to try and go for it again. And this didn't turn people away. It made people root for us. We had, like, people that were like, well, what's happening now? Like, what are you doing? Wait, are you going to contact the same people? Are you going to go try to interview with them again? And people were interested because that hero's journey, that the odyssey, that's what people don't just want to hear about the success at the end. They want to know about the trials and tribulations so they could reverse engineer for themselves, what do I do when I face adversity? And I think what's problematic is, again, in this culture of happiness and cheerfulness, is we treat the Thomas Jeffersons, the Martin Luther Kings, the Mahatma Gandhi, as if they were perfect heroes to worship, and we pretend they didn't have warts. We pretend that they were great fathers. We pretend that they were great husbands. And actually, history shows a lot of these guys were pricks, annoying, obnoxious, exploitive, manipulative, and at the same time, brilliant, charismatic, admirable, and did amazing things. And only by seeing the whole picture of their personality can we, and the next generation replicate these geniuses and these great figures in history.
Yeah, I think this is so important, and we're quickly running out of time, and I don't want to neglect the depression. And you use the term low moods, which I learned from evolutionary psychologist Randy Ness, who does some work in this area. And then his notion is that low moods are these evolutionary adaptations designed to make us stop some futile activity, like chipping into a tree to look for the meat. They psychologically slow us down so we don't just do that and die, or would have died back, you know, before there were Twinkies and 7-Elevens. So what are your notions about depression? And, I mean, of course, nobody wants to be in a deep clinical depression, but these sort of, you know, you have some setbacks and you feel like maybe you feel like staying in bed for a few days.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly right. And I'm really glad. And Niess is an amazing thinker. This evolutionary approach to emotions is really the underpinnings of this entire book. We just didn't want to, because we wanted this for the layperson, we put it all into the 50 pages of endnotes, and it's not in the story itself. But this whole book is about functional approach to emotions. Instead of asking, what will I feel if I do this, ask, what will this emotion or thought do for me? And sadness, as you said, there's a reason we get sad. We get sad because we are not able to do something by ourselves. We require the support of other people. We require a time to conserve our energy because right now we're not at our full intellectual capacity. Physically, we're not at our full speed. And so we experience this emotion as a sense of, it's almost like this emotion is hundreds of thousands of years of evolution that gives you a very quick impulse to stop what you're doing, slow down, conserve energy for a rainy day when you actually are required to use this energy, and find other people that you can leverage so you can be a super organism and have their strength at your disposal, feeling a little bit weak at the time, or you're feeling like you can't get out of bed, and you're feeling as if you can't think, and your mind is foggy. And yes, it's very different than what we're talking about clinical depression, when you're talking about, you know, suicidal thoughts and the inability to concentrate and, you know, eating more or less than is typical for you, you know, this is for extensive periods of time. Experiencing sadness is a very normal experience, and when we try not to experience that, that's when problems start to arise.
And I just want to say, your book, The Upside of Your Dark Side, was such an influence on me. I saw a friend this afternoon, you know, she's been having a bad time at her job and felt really bad, but it helped her realize she wants to do something else and what she wants to do and everything. And I was telling her about your book and telling her, this is so good. You know, this bad feeling, if you felt just sort of, if your job didn't really, really suck, if your job was just kind of like, okay, well, I don't really love it, then you wouldn't have been motivated to look elsewhere. And it's just so important, you know, this thinking that you're talking about. And I wanted to just have you talk about how, you know, it's probably the last thing we have time for. You don't advocate, you know, going out and being miserable to the point, you know, you want to end it all. You talk about what you advocate is mild unhappiness. I like how you put that. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, I mean, we actually use a metaphor of, it's like running a race with five laps, you know, 5K, which is when you first start a race, you're optimistic. You're with a bunch of other people that like to exercise, people that are excited, people are doing this for causes, you know, they're donating the money for someplace, and you're all a team. You're there's love, there's kindness, and that carries over to the second lap, and you're feeling the dopamine surge through your body. By the third lap, it requires a little bit more grittiness, right? A little bit more mental strain. You start being a little bit competitive with other people. You see the other person who's running in front of you, and you imagine they have lice in their hair, and you've got to run past them because they have some disease you don't want to catch. And by the fourth and fifth lap, you know, we interviewed marathon runners, we interviewed Army Rangers, and Navy SEALs. And on that fifth and final lap, they said, asshole, I hate people that are running in front of me. I loathe them. I don't want to be near them. I want to crush them. I want to stamp on their souls. And that's it. It's not that they're bad people. It's a motivational force to get them through that last lap where they do not, they're going past their physical capacity. They can barely breathe. What motivates them is hate. What motivates them is defensive pessimism, the belief that I hope this works out, but I am prepared to fall apart and have a heart attack right here, right now. These are the emotional and psychological states we have in that final lap. And so the majority of the time, we are advocating for love, happiness, compassion, peace, kindness, joy, playfulness, but appreciate this last lap. Appreciate the times, the few times that require to deviate tremendously from happiness to sadness, anger, guilt, boredom, anxiety, because it's exactly what you need under certain circumstances.
Yeah, that is just such important thinking. I love your book. I've been talking with Dr. Todd Kashtan. His book is The Upside of Your Dark Side, Why Being Your Whole Self, Not Just Your Good Self, Drives Success and Fulfillment. Thank you so much. This was such an illuminating show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I'm just psyched because I now found your book, which is going on my Amazon wish list.
Thank you. Good manners for nice people sometimes say fuck.